This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Lois Rudnick. She is a cultural historian. She's co-editor of the new book, Mabel Dodge Lujan and Company, American Moderns and the West. And the exhibition by the same name opens on May 22nd of this year at the Harwood Museum of Art. And in fact, we are coming to you today from Mabel Dodge Lujan's house. We're sitting in a little room, which is a log cabin and a fireplace, and it's an amazing place to be. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. And I just love doing this in situ, as it were.
Yeah, it's quite amazing to be here and get the flavor and the feel for who this woman was, which I guess is enough of an enigma that somebody like you has been researching her life and work for over four decades.
Yes, indeed, among many other things that I've done in my life, but absolutely that is true.
Now, how did the concept for this new book and exhibition come into being?
Well, actually, it also has a long history. Malin Wilson Powell wrote a grant to NEH, a planning grant that she got for a show called Mabel Dodge Lujan and Company in 1980. And at that point, Mabel Dodge Lujan was way more of an enigma than she is now after my writing and editing some five books about her and two or three books about members of her writers and artists circle. So we never had the legs to get this going as an exhibition because so few people remembered her at that time. And I met Malin when she was working on this project in the early 80s. We've been friends since then. And when I retired from the University of Massachusetts in Boston and moved here in 2009, I met with Malin and said, you know, this seems to me to be a good time for us to try to really do the show. She agreed. I'd already published a biography of Mabel, a biography of the house, and edited her published memoirs at that point. And so we came up to the Harwood and spoke with the then director, who was very excited because Taos has never done any public exhibition about Mabel or any of her circle.
Which is kind of amazing.
It is kind of amazing since she, as many critics said in the 1920s, put Taos on the map of modern American culture and was certainly well known regionally, nationally, and internationally throughout most of her life until post-World War II, when her life really quieted down a great deal. But she had been all but forgotten until I came upon an essay in a book about her by Christopher Lash, who was a cultural historian like myself, and became interested in her and took her as the topic of my dissertation, never having come to New Mexico until I completed said dissertation at Brown, and then finding myself in love with the place and wanting to turn my work into a book, which has turned into several other books, and really a kind of lifelong research project because her tentacles reached in so many directions across so many boundaries of society and culture and psychology and art and theater and poetry in four different worlds: the world of Gilded Age Buffalo, the world of expatriate fantasy Ecola Florence, where she had a villa and began her career as a salon hostess, the world of avant-garde radical political aesthetic New York before World War I, and then the world of Taos, New Mexico that she came to after the war when she was so disillusioned by the militarism and violence of American and European life and wanted to find someplace that was a completely different world from the worlds that she had known before.
Now, let's give a little bit of history and context. Some of our listeners may be new to Mabel Dodge Lujan, and some may
shocking.
Shocking to you. But she was a wealthy
Yes.
Debutante.
Yes. She grew up in Gilded Age Victorian Buffalo, the daughter of one of the first families of Delaware Avenue, which is where all the wealthiest Buffalonians lived in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s.
Born in 1879.
Yep. And of two parents who disliked each other and had no interest in their only child. And so she spent a childhood raised by nannies in a world which later in her very astute insight, she described as a world in which the class she was born into substituted power for love.
Yeah.
And so she grew up knowing that if she wanted to have anything in life, it would have to be by having power over other people, and of course, mostly men, since men are the ones who held all the economic, political, and social power in the world in which she grew up. And at the same time, she loathed that role for women and wanted to be a powerful, independent woman in her own right. And this conflict between a woman must create through a man, can serve as a muse for a man, can be a patron and supporter of male creativity and genius, and her alternate contradictory desire to be an independent creative woman in her own right was a contradiction she never resolved in her own life. It was with her permanently until I think she died.
Although she did so much work, I mean, she became such a creator through her patronage.
Yes, exactly. And one of the things that I came upon in my research for this, when we were working on the book and the exhibition, that excited me more than anything I think I've ever discovered was when I found a letter from Marston Hartley, one of the first great modernist painters that she brought out to Taos even before she owned land and a home here in 1918, who wrote to Alfred Stieglitz. He met her in New York.
Alfred Stieglitz,
the great photographer and the great patron of avant-garde art, who was already showing European modern works before the Armory Show brought hundreds of them to the United States in 1913.
And the eventual husband of Georgia O'Keeffe.
Yes, and the eventual husband of Georgia O'Keeffe. Marston Hartley wrote a letter to Stieglitz in 1914 in which he said, like you, Mabel Dodge Lujan is a real creator of creators.
Yeah.
And I chose that phrase for the title of my essay in the book because I felt I've been looking for a way to describe the creative work that she did. And this is one of the conundrums about women who have played the role as salon hostess and patron throughout the centuries, wealthy women in Europe and the United States, that the kind of work they were doing is not the kind of work that is typically acknowledged in art museums. It's the behind-the-scenes work, like, that no one gets to see. It's the person who creates a creative space, brings people together to play off one another, provides them with the opportunity for peace and quiet to do their work, buys their work, negotiates through letters their entree to people who will publish them, their poetry, or will hang their work in exhibitions in their galleries, as she did for many of the artists and writers she surrounded herself with. But it's not a role that most people have taken very seriously, especially, I think, in the United States, where we are a culture of show me what you made, show me what you produced. It needs to, what's its value? What is it worth? How many people have looked at it and read it? Who wants it? And her role was one step behind that, which was providing a space and place and places for people to be able to do the kind of work that allowed them to produce, let's say, exciting new ways of thinking about landscape and indigenous cultures and long-lived cultures in the Southwest, which were not part of American modernism until Mabel came out here and brought others to see it.
One of the things that I think Mabel lets us think about is the sort of myth of the lone and lonely genius working by him or herself or whatever, because the truth is, and the reality is, that nobody ever gets anything done alone.
Right.
They either have a supporter or a network of support or a group of support or somebody who loves them. And it's not just like the support of money or a studio, but it's the support, and I think Mabel was this, of somebody who sees the vision, who can understand with whom that artist or writer or whatever it is in a conversation. And that conversation is part of the work. So it's not just like, oh, I'm a patron giving you a grant. It's right. Like, I am part of this creation. Right.
So one of the things I discovered in my, it's hard to step back for a moment and say, you would imagine that after writing about, researching this woman for 42 years, there'd be nothing new left to say about her. But in the last 20 years since I wrote my last biography of her and the artist she brought to Taos, so many new books have been published of letters and memoirs of many of the writers and artists who are part of her circle that I did not have access to before, because I didn't have money to travel to every collection in the country that had these people's letters. And so, for example, now I know that although Thornton Wilder came here four times and loved Mabel and got along with her famously, as many people did or did not, he found her to be an extraordinary mentor and critic of his work, something I did not know. Now, he never wrote about Taos, but she read his manuscripts. In fact, I learned through my new research that she was one of the forces behind his play Skin of Our Teeth being produced on Broadway. And she was credited with that in a New Yorker piece. I did not know that before. So it's just... This is the kind of background material that one would never know about her unless you have access to primary source material. You read all of the letters. But it was true throughout her life. When she was in New York, the man who turned out to be one of the most innovative theater designers in the United States, Bobby Edmund Jones, was so poor he could not afford an apartment. He lived with her in her apartment in New York, in a guest room. She raised money to send him to Europe to study with the most avant-garde theater designers. He called her his mother. Later on in the 20s, she sent him to get therapy with Jung in Switzerland.
Oh my goodness.
And he said, you saved my physical life in my 20s, and you're saving my mental life in my 30s. And so that is not a role that necessarily shows in his productions, although he did come out in 1919 and 1920 to Taos, and one of the most outrageous scenic designs he ever did was a version of Taos Pueblo that he made as a setting for Macbeth.
Oh my goodness.
That got like... Nobody knew what to make of it. I've only seen a few of the drawings, but people must have said, where did this come from? And it came from his being enthralled by seeing a culture and architecture that he had never seen before. He even designed a theater for the New World that he hoped one day would be built out here, and it never happened. But this is the kind of synergy that happened constantly throughout her life, beginning with Gertrude Stein, who visited her in Florence toward the end of her stay there during the time when she was trying to recreate the Renaissance in her beautiful 15th century Medician villa. And Stein thought she was absolutely fascinating and wrote this cubist word portrait of her that nobody understood except Stein and Mabel. And Mabel brought it back to the United States when she moved to New York in 1912 and had it 300 copies printed and bound in Florentine wallpaper and passed it out at the Armory Show as a literary version of what the avant-garde painters were doing in America and the States, and wrote one of the most perceptive articles about Gertrude Stein's literary revolution, linguistic revolution that was ever written about her in these early years, and really introduced her to her American audience, for which Gertrude was entirely ungrateful because Mabel was getting too much of the credit. And these two egos were like giants clashing.
Right. We're talking to Lois Rudnick about the exhibition and book Mabel Dodge, Lujan and Company, American Moderns and the West. Now, here we are sitting in the Mabel Dodge, Lujan house here in Taos on a beautiful spring day.
Yes.
And sort of trying to get the feel, I mean, she was somebody who would go and buy or rent villas and sumptuous, gigantic, sort of palatial houses, apartments, whatever, whether she was in New York or whether she was in Florence, wherever she went. And when you're here, I mean, she bought a little adobe house that was four rooms and right. added on to it. But although it's, I mean, I guess it's big by
square
most
footage.
Of our standards. There's a kind of smallness and modesty and intimacy
yes.
to this house. How did she end up here? And what did she do when she was here? What was the vision? How did that evolve?
Well, she never could have the vision of her desire to find, to create a world in which she could be at home began in Florence with an escape from the horrible Gilded Age Victorian Buffalo to a world that she believed had everything that anybody could ever want in terms of the greatest philosophy, the greatest literature, the greatest music that had ever been created. America was like a wasteland to her at that point in the early 20th century. And she felt, if I could build a home for myself and a life for myself that honored the highest point in human creativity and thinking, the Italian Renaissance, everything will be fine. And she found it to be eventually a very phony kind of life for an American woman to live. It was Gertrude Stein who said to her, "You're a mercurial, temperamental, energetic American, and you belong in the United States fomenting revolution over there, not pretending you're a Renaissance princess in a villa." She said, fine. She went back.
Yes, Gertrude, yes, whatever Gertrude. You say.
She was a little in love with Gertrude, and Alice was not happy about that, so she came back to the United States.
And she did have some lesbian history.
She did have some lesbian history.
Even though she was married, girl. Like, how many times?
She was married 4 times, but in her schoolgirl days, and she writes about this very openly in her published memoirs, and she didn't really write about it so much during her European years, but while she was married to her second husband, Edwin Dodge, who was an architect who helped to renovate the villa and had the money to buy it, she continued to have affairs with, there was a group of lesbian women who had their own kind of subculture and world in Florence. Florence was a place where you could find your own space and be left alone, even though the Florentines were a very traditional Catholic society. And she experimented, but I think once she started to read Freud and began to see the theories about how people were not fully evolved or fully developed if they were attracted to members of their own sex, she really pushed that aside in her life. And when she came back to America, she got a note from her doctor saying that her husband, Edwin, was making her sick, so he apologized and left the apartment at 23 Fifth Avenue on the edge of Greenwich Village. And friends that she'd known in Florence began to bring the really interesting people, the anarchists and the people like Emma Goldman and Margaret Sanger. A.A. Brill, who was the first translator of Freud, gave some of the first public talks on Freudian psychoanalysis at her salon. Walter Lippmann said, "You have this way of bringing people out. You should have a salon." And hers was the first of its kind in New York City. And it remained unique in the sense that there wasn't a single upheaval in social thought or psychological theory or political action that our aesthetic theory that did not have a home in her apartment, where people fiercely debated such things as, how do you create a just economy? How do you create balance between men and women? Can a woman be a free lover? Can she also be a mother? Can she have a profession? What is better, traditional art that sort of speaks for and to and can only be owned by the privileged and the wealthy, or an art that shows the world as it actually is, the ash cans as well as the palaces? And so she called it a free speech salon. And she said, out of the welter of ideas may come a way of creating a more beautiful, just society in which human beings can be fully formed.
And so this is an example of creating a space not only for artists, but for all the kind of creators and innovators
exactly.
in society.
Thinkers and actors and world, and as she called it in her memoir about New York, the movers and shakers who are trying to figure out how we can create a world that is not just about raping the earth and impoverishing people and marginalizing those who are different from us, different ethnic groups, different races, who are not white and Anglo-Saxon Protestant. How do we create a world in which everybody belongs and everyone can aspire and fulfill their individuality?
And this was 100 years ago, and
yes.
We're still trying to do the same thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Part of my interest in Mabel was that I grew up in the 50s, not so different from the Victorian age, and emerged as a radical activist and feminist in the 60s. And I sort of felt like her trajectory was not so different from mine, except that our generation of radicals in the 60s thought we were thinking of all these questions for the very first time. And, you know, lots of people had been thinking about, how do we create a just society? How do men and women women have relationships in which they are equal and supportive of each other, dependent and independent, all that. How do we stop in stupid wars that are completely pointless from happening? And that's what they were, her group of people were, they formed anti-militarism groups during World War I. They spoke out against the stupidity of this war, of America's entering this war. One of the greatest anti-war writers in American history, Randolph Bourne, was part of this generation, not part of her group, who wrote anti-imperialist essays that were just absolutely incredible. And here they were doing this in 1914, 1915, 1916. And we were asking the same exact questions in the 60s, and many of us are still asking them today.
And some of those questions were being asked in ancient Greece.
Exactly.
We're talking to Lois Rudnick about Mabel Dodge Lujan. So Mabel comes to Taos, and one of the things that I think is so interesting is the ongoing academic debate about what happens when this sort of like East Coast Anglo-American influence of modernism comes in and interacts with Native American and Hispanic art and artists. Some people frame it as a kind of dominant colonialist attitude.
As a kind of cultural imperialism.
Cultural imperialism. And then it can also be framed as a real like learning from each other. Like, how do you see what happened, and how does that enter into the show that is at the Harwood Museum?
I would say over the last 20 years, I have wrestled in many different ways with the whole notion of what Anglo patronage is all about, and what does it mean when a first world culture meets a third world culture. And I've spent a lot of my life trying to sort of moderate between a kind of what I'd call essentialist view that this is all bad, that whenever white patrons enter a world in which they are patronizing, supporting, whether it's African Americans during the Harlem Renaissance, or it's Appalachians during the 1920s, or it's Native Americans and Hispanos during Mabel's tenure here, that nothing can come from this except exploitation. And a view that I think many more people who don't read academic books, which is the vast
majority of human
beings in the world, who think all this is quite wonderful. What if we didn't have the Museum of Fine Arts in Santa Fe? What if we didn't have the Harwood Foundation? What if we didn't have SAR? You know, what if we didn't have the Wheelwright Museum? All of these extraordinary cultural institutions, to use Northern New Mexico as an example, were created by Anglo patrons who wanted to preserve, protect, and honor the indigenous arts and the arts of Hispanos, the creations they made, the santos, the bultos or tablos, as well as support Pueblo easel painting, which was a new medium for Pueblos to work in that began in the 1910s in Santa Fe. And I've always tried to mediate between these two points of view, and I think one of my great revelations was reading the work by a wonderful anthropologist, Ruth Miller, who said there are many ways to tell this story, and one does not discount the other. This story is about Euro-Americans, especially women, coming to New Mexico, to Santa Fe and Taos in particular, and finding a kind of power in recognizing the beauty, the spirituality, and the aesthetic beauty and the meaningfulness of Hispano folk Catholicism and Native American ceremonials and pottery and paintings, and having a kind of leverage over presenting them to the rest of the country who never knew these people existed. So that gave them a power they would not have had in the worlds they came from.
I mean, I suppose the counterargument to that is you only preserve a culture after you've almost entirely destroyed it.
Yes. Well, there is the whole noble savage phenomenon, which became part of the kind of painting images of the early Taos Society of Artists, of these handsome, noble Native Americans, often dressed in inappropriate clothes that were really not part of their culture, was part of a privileging of a population, most of which had been decimated throughout the rest of the United States. The attraction of northern New Mexico were 19 Pueblo tribes that were still living cultures on their own land. who had been here for 600, 800, 1,000 years, and who had not were not on reservations, had not been removed the way other Native Americans had, and seemed to, particularly to those who were attentive to the horrific brutality of World War I, to have found a way to live and create and incorporate religion, spirituality, and art into their daily living and daily practice that made much more sense for living a peaceful, non-exploitative life, non-exploitative of the land and non-exploitative of other people, which is why they were so cathected. Cathected to these groups.
She's an academic, ladies and gentlemen.
I try not to be, but sometimes it comes out inadvertently. So that, and in that wanting to honor marginalized groups that most Americans couldn't have cared less about and knew nothing about, and to say that what they created was part of our national cultural patrimony, and I wish matrimony were an equivalent word, right, but it's not. They were doing things all to the good and to the benefit of helping us understand ourselves as a multicultural nation. Insofar as they wanted to determine what they should create, how they should paint, paid them very little money for being models for their work. Insofar as they, in their writing and art, didn't acknowledge the serious poverty and ill health that was part of the declining economy of northern New Mexico from the 1910s through today, they did not do great service to these communities. So it is a complicated story that cannot be simplified either as, you know, colonial exploitation or cultural imperialism, or as just look at the great benefits they brought to these artists who never would have been able to make these creations if they weren't part of it. And they influenced one another in the work they did. These were mutual influences on both sides.
Well, I think that's one of the things that's so interesting about the exhibition that's opening at the Harwood Museum, which is that in that show you have examples of work by Native American people, by Hispanos of northern New Mexico, by Anglo painters, by all kinds of people who came together in really interesting ways.
Yes, and influenced one another's work. It wasn't just Euro-Americans finding new religious ceremonials, whether they be Hispano penitentes or Native American ceremonial, you know, the green corn dance ceremonials, to paint or write about. But it was also these artists taking, learning from Anglo-European, Euro-American artists how to use their own ideas of modern art and incorporate them into their own Pueblo modernism or Hispano modernism. And typically these, the tri-ethnic groups that we think of as the dominant populations of New Mexico, are, when they are exhibited in what I would call segregated exhibitions. So there were several exhibitions in Santa Fe over the last year about American modernism, and not a single one of them had a Pueblo artist or an Hispano artist in them.
Yeah.
Even though most of this work couldn't have been made if these folks hadn't come out here, even Georgia O'Keeffe, her cross paintings, which is so unbelievable, are all about the penitente crosses in the mountains of northern New Mexico.
Yeah.
So we have them talking to each other in dialogue, as many of them were in life, in the exhibition.
And I think that's one of the interesting things that an art exhibition can do, which is place things near each other in such a way that the viewer walking through them can start to make those connections.
Exactly.
And there's also, you know, text, there's the catalog, this wonderful book. But, I mean, this is the whole thing. Our way of seeing art and literature, at least in this sort of Anglo-American culture, is individuals, which is also how, you know, individual rights under the law and all those were in this, like it or not, and conscious of it or not, we're in a culture of seeing individuals.
Right.
And this helps you to think about groups of people, about pairs of people, about societies of people.
Right.
And that is actually the way human beings
Absolutely.
Live.
Absolutely. So next time you go through the Albuquerque airport, and you come up from the baggage claim area on the escalator, and you look at the two fabulous murals on that second floor that are straight ahead of you before you go to your gate. Both of these magnificent murals are by Pop Shelley, Marina Lujan, who was Tony Lujan's niece, and who Mabel told out of the blue one day, and this was told to me by Pop Shelley herself, that she should go to the Dorothy Dunn School and become an easel painter. And she did, and she loved it, and she became one of the most famous painters who graduated from the Dorothy Dunn School and was commissioned to do many murals, and those two are part of the Albuquerque Airport art collection, and they are superb, absolutely superb. So we have some of her work, of course, in the exhibition as well.
And I think that points to another feature of Mabel Dodge Lujan, which is this kind of deep intuition. Like,
yes.
How did she know that this young woman should be a painter? It wasn't like she'd been painting.
I have absolutely no idea how Mabel came up with her intuition. She was self-educated. She never graduated high school. She did read a great deal, but she worked primarily from her intuition and from, as she said, putting herself to school with the best people in whatever field it was that interested her. So she said Alfred Stieglitz, when she moved to New York, taught her how to see. You know, and she was humble enough, because she wasn't well educated, to really be able to learn from other people and to listen to what it is they had to teach. That's one of the reasons her salon, Lincoln Steffen, said, "This is the most successful salon I have ever been to in my life, because of your ability to throw out ideas and then sit back and listen and let other people talk."
And humility is not a word that we would normally associate with Mabel Dodge.
No, it isn't. No, it isn't, because she could be a very difficult, challenging person. She suffered from manic depression throughout her adult life, and it sometimes eventuated in acts of cruelty and meanness to people whom she loved. She never received the kind of parenting a child should receive to really know how to love herself. But one of the things that I admire greatly about her, although of course I certainly don't admire everything about her, is her honesty and willingness to write about her flawed self in the hope, as she put it in her 1,500 pages of memoirs, that others would not have to suffer through what she did. By knowing that what she was going through is manic depression, I think she may have been the first to write about it in a memoir.
Although we might have to suffer through her 1,500 pages.
Yes, indeed. That's, which is why I abridged them into a modest 250 pages that are the best of her four volumes of memoirs.
We're talking to Lois Rudnick about Mabel Dodge Lujan. One of the things that I think is so interesting also, and that you've touched on a little bit in this whole question of early 20th century modernism, is the kind of American at that time insecurity about our culture as opposed to European culture.
Yes.
So like everything that was going on in New York or on the East Coast or whatever was like some perhaps pale imitation of what was going on in Paris. But here were all of these artists and writers trying to find something that really was American and that had a deep American
right.
identity. And part of that was the people who actually have lived here for a lot longer than
yes.
Euro-Americans had lived here.
Yes, indeed. And so there is this movement before and after World War I around cultural nationalism, which has to do with an inferiority complex that most of us who are living in the 21st century America can't imagine Americans ever having an inferiority complex about anything. And many of the travelers who came here from Europe in the 19th century and early 20th century wrote about the United States. You guys can make anything. You can build anything. You have a lot of nature, but you ain't got no culture worth speaking of. Everything you do, your music, your literature, your art, it's all imitative. Your artists have to go and study in Europe, because really there isn't, you know, there aren't art schools worth a damn here in the United States. And there were many Americans who felt that one of the things that American civilization lacked was a heart and a soul and a spirit, and that is what the humanities and the arts bring to a civilization. And that, indeed, they bought into the theory that we shouldn't just be drawing our ideas of art and literature and music from Europe, but we should be finding our own indigenous myths and symbols from our own civilization. And one of the things that enthralled those cultural nationalists who were writing for major poetry magazines and having beautiful exhibits, as Alfred Stieglitz was in his Gallery 291, and then An American Place, which was named An American Place to honor American artists, was finding cultures, the Hispano and Pueblo in particular, who had been here from 500 years to 1,000, and that were still living, thriving cultures, and that had offered a way of thinking about American origins, not as having started in 1620 when the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock, which is what most Americans believed. First there was Columbus in 1492, then there's this huge gap, and then the Pilgrims come. This is how I was brought up in Boston. And in 1620, they land on the rock, and the Puritans and the Britain, this is where our heritage comes from. Everything that's great about America came from Northern Europe, most particularly Britain. So they're saying, wait a minute, there's this whole Spanish civilization that mixed in with this indigenous population to create a kind of mestizo population, but still has its own separate cultures, or they may have borrowed from each other. And they were here long before the Pilgrims ever set foot on this land, and they offer us something equivalent to what we think we have to go to Egypt, Rome, and Greece to get.
And I think there was also an equivalent thing going on with Black American culture.
At the exact same time that Alice Corbin Henderson and Mabel and all of the Euro-Americans who are coming out to Santa Fe and Taos are writing these essays in national magazines saying, you don't have to go to Athens. You don't have to go to Cairo. Come to the Southwest, living, thriving cultures with fabulous archaeological interest and beautiful ceremonials and arts that no one else has ever created in the history of this country. They're all claiming that this is where we should come to find our source of a truly original American art. But you also have patrons in New York that helped to foment the Harlem Renaissance, whites who patronize Black writers like Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston for good or ill, but do help their work get produced and recognized in ways that are extraordinary, that has never happened before for an African-American intelligentsia. Some of this is about exoticism, you know, the need for the primitive, for people who are untainted by making war and by making industrial machines and mass manufactured everything. So some of it is fantasized and romanticized, but it is also offers a genuine platform for extraordinary writers and musicians in the African American community to get published and recognized for the amazing work that they're able to do. There are people doing this in Appalachia saying, well, Appalachia is this old culture, people coming from the Scotch-Irish in the 17th century. So there's this attempt to try to find something other than the Western civilization that's just devoured itself in 13 million soldiers and civilians in this horrendous, stupid, wasteful war.
World War One.
Yes.
We're talking to Lois Rudnick about the book and exhibition Mabel Dodge Lujan and Company, American Moderns and the West. And the book is a co-production of yours and the work of Malin Wilson Powell.
Yes.
And it's a beautiful book, rich with color reproductions of the work, photographs, and all kinds of documents of that time. And I understand that this was a great step forward because you actually got to print all this stuff in color.
Yes, this was. There are other contributors to this wonderful book. Let me just say that Wanda Korn, who is a marvelous historian of modern American art and who did a terrific exhibition on Gertrude Stein, which was similar in nature to what we're doing with Mabel a couple of years ago, wrote the introduction. And Carmela Padilla, who is a well-known and well-loved, long-lived Hispana from northern New Mexico, wrote the essay on Anglo-patronage of Hispano artists. So it's wonderful to have several essays with very different points of view on Mabel and her circle in the book. For me, the most exciting thing, aside from that I'm not writing the whole book myself, is to see the work in color, because I've published several books on Mabel, but all of the images in these books have had to be in black and white because of the expense of publishing in color. And we were fortunate enough to receive a subvention for this book from a wonderful person here in Taos. So we were able to to have these gorgeous color illustrations. And to see this work in color is to see this work for me for the first time.
Yeah. The exhibition at the Harwood Museum has a lot of pieces in it that have been seen by very few people.
Yes.
And you had some, like, adventures and great finds.
Indeed, we did. And I'll tell you two of the best stories. One is an extraordinary painting the size of a queen-size bed, which sounds rather vulgar, that was a portrait of Mabel that was done at the Villa Carogna in Florence by a very well-known French portrait painter who painted some of the greatest writers and composers and dancers in Europe, Nijinsky, Stravinsky, Henry James. He came to the Villa in 1911, and at the same time that Gertrude Stein was creating her Cubist word portrait, he's painting Mabel as this traditional, beautiful Renaissance princess in gorgeous silks and velvet gown. And the painting, I knew where the painting was. It was in Buffalo in the basement of the Albright Knox. 3 years ago, I went to see it, and they pulled it out for me. And it was, the paint was peeling off the canvas, and the gilding on the frame was in pieces. And in my naive way, I said to the conservator, is there something we can do to fix it? She said, well, I don't know. 2 weeks later, I get a letter in which she said, I found a professor at Buffalo State University whose graduate class in conservation will take on the restoration of the painting as their project for no money.
Oh, my goodness.
So they restored it. And then the museums that are involved in the exhibition, as well as the Albright that owns it, all chipped in to pay for the restoration of the frame. So that was an incredible. So it is coming to Taos. It looks like something you'd expect to see in the Louvre.
Yeah.
The other story is much more touching and much more local, and that is there is a well-known Taos storyteller and children's book writer whose name is Jonathan Warmday Cumming, whose grandfather was a well-known model for many of the Taos Society artists and became a model for Marie Stern, Mabel's third husband, who was the one who actually came out before her and told her she had to come out here and save the Indians and show their culture to the world. And Maurice was only here for a brief time, 9 months, but he did a beautiful bust of Jonathan Warmday Cumming's father, grandfather. And I discovered where it was in the basement of the Art Institute of Chicago. A friend of mine asked if I could send a picture of it to Jonathan Warmday Cumming. He got the picture from me. He wrote, he called the curator and said, we would give anything to have this in the, if this could come to the exhibition. And we had already petitioned to have it in the exhibition and been turned down. So I called the curator. I didn't know Jonathan did this separately. I called the curator of the Art Institute and said to her, why can't we have this bust, this bronze bust? And she said, I don't know. I'll find out. So 2 hours later, she emails me and says, it's just a broken pedestal. It can be fixed. You don't have to pay anything for that, and we can loan it to you. 2 hours later than that, she writes, I don't even know why we have this piece. It's been sitting in the basement since Mabel Dodge Lujan donated it in 1933, after it was shown once in an exhibition. You people should have it. You want it? So she said, of course, I have to ask permission of the board of directors if we can deaccession it. And Juniper found somebody who would pay for it very reasonably. Juniper at the Harwood. Juniper Maliad, fabulous development director. And it is now coming permanently to the Harwood as part of their collection. And it's wonderful.
Yeah.
So it's a, just these two wonderful. Two of these are the two best stories.
And those are just two. And
those are just two.
Yeah, and there's more. I mean, paintings that came out of basements and
yes,
restorations.
About 26% of the works on view have rarely or never been seen, either because they have been locked away in basements like this unbelievable Dorothy Brett Feather Dance painting,
yeah,
which was at the Harry Ransom Center in Austin that Malin found, or they have been in private collections and they have not been shown in exhibitions. So we are very excited by the freshness of some of the works that people are going to see. They're going to say, I've never seen that before. It's extraordinary. Where has that been all my life?
Right, right.
And it's at the Harwood.
Now, this exhibition opens at the Harwood Museum of Art in Taos, New Mexico, on May 22nd of this year. It's there through September. Then in October, the end of October, it moves to the Albuquerque Museum, where it is through January of next year. And after that, it's going to Buffalo, New York, which is where Mabel Dodge Lujan was from.
Yep.
And is there from March through the end of May
2017. Yes, indeed. And Buffalo also has never had anything on Mabel, so this is a first for them. It will be at the Birchfield Penny.
Amazing.
Beautiful, beautiful contemporary museum on the campus of Buffalo State University.
Meanwhile, while we're here in New Mexico, and the majority of our listeners are in Taos, Santa Fe, and this general area of northern New Mexico, there's quite a lot of programs that are going on.
Yes.
Including you are giving a symposium weekend?
Yes, we have a symposium weekend where Leslie Dillon will be doing her one fabulous one-act play, Passions of Mabel Dodge.
Yeah.
It's terrific. And then we have a symposium with Wanda Korn, Bill Anses, who's written on Pueblo Modernism, Carmela Padilla, Malin, and myself, talking about some of the themes in the exhibition and the book. And on Sunday morning, we have Carmela Quinta and Sylvia Rodriguez, who are long-lived Hispanas whose families have been here for about 500 years, talking about the impact of Anglos on life, Hispano life in New Mexico in the 20th century.
Do you think that this conversation has come to a point of real kind of listening and complexity and nuance as opposed to sort of hitting each other on the head kind of thing?
Oh, absolutely. Well, certainly with the people who are speaking, who are part of our programming, that is absolutely true. I mean, there are still disparate points of view, and there have to be disparate points of view. That's one of the things we're trying to honor in the exhibition and in the programming. Can I just announce the website for the exhibition, where you can find all the programs for the summer under the calendar section? MabelDodgeLujan.org.
MabelDodgeLujan.org.
Yes.
Lois Rudnick is a cultural historian. You've been working on, among other things, the life and work of Mabel Dodge Lujan for over four decades. And I wanted to ask you before we go, do you think, I mean, Mabel Dodge Lujan came into the world, as you've talked about, a woman who was given power and money, but not love.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a kind of funny paradox that a lot of people who have that kind of history actually go on to do great things because they're always looking for something that they didn't get.
Exactly. And she's very open about that.
And do you think she ended her life fulfilled? Did she find what she was looking for? I mean, did she find love? Did she find fulfillment?
I think that's a very hard question to answer. Her relationship with Tony, the marriage lasted over 40 years, was both loving and fraught in many different ways for reasons that I've written about in other work. She never was able to turn Taos into the utopian community that she dreamed of. When she wrote sort of nostalgically in the late 40s and 50s about the wonders of what had happened here in the 20s and 30s and 40s, I think she took great pride in what she was able to accomplish. But I also think she was never able to really find a kind of stasis point for herself where she could integrate herself enough to be at peace. And that was part of the reason, paradoxically, she was so restless and so reaching out to find every conceivable answer that might, you know, tell her how to become a full, whole human being who could be at peace with herself. It's one of the sources of her creativity. Whether she was ever fully at peace, I don't think so. I just don't think she was capable of that, except maybe in her last years. But she had a will to live and a drive to overcome her physical and particularly her psychological disabilities that is incredibly admirable. And she was an amazing therapist for friends of hers at the worst times in their lives. She would be there to support them. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't know about her that I find very powerful and moving.
Now, are you, after all of these years, done with Mabel Dodge Lujan?
I think I probably am done, unless I discover something in her afterlife that makes me feel I have to go there. But that's highly unlikely because of all of the many people who have met her ghost at her home, even though I've slept in her bed and come out here for the last 30 years and stayed here, she has never deigned to speak with me. So I think we're going to leave it at this.
On that note, ladies and gentlemen, it's time to go. Once again, the exhibition opens on May 22nd at the Harwood Museum of Art in Taos, New Mexico. Lois Rudnick, cultural historian, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, such a great pleasure. Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.